heard a lot of that at the rally that I've attended, in the right kind of trouble. And I think it was. I like the quote about coalition isn't broad enough if it doesn't contain people that you're uncomfortable with. So
yeah.
we got to work through it. And is this?
Okay. It's your mic.
Yeah, I guess I should have waited till you shut down.
That's okay.
Well, I'm operating through a different mechanism here today, so bear with me. And it's been an insomniacal week for me again. I don't go around and wander the streets. Maybe I should look like a maniac because I can't sleep. But anyway, I hope you're ready for some material I've garnered around late-breaking New York, a unanimous decision from the Extreme Court. Now, isn't that amazing? But it says that Trump should facilitate the return of the person that they sent and admitted that he was not a not who they thought he was. Yeah, just like the hairdresser guy that's gay that had a Real Madrid tattoo on it, which has a crown in the icon for Real Madrid, and they thought it was a gang tat. So, I mean, and then there was the guy that had a tattoo dedicated to his autistic brother that somehow got interpreted as being a gang tat. These are the people that haven't been examined. So I'm going to talk about that. In fact, but most of these things are I'm going to present material on this, were recorded on Thursday, so they don't actually reflect. Erwin Chemerinsky, who's head of the law department out at UC Berkeley, got a fairly lengthy segment with him that lines out some of this onrush of cases and sorts it out a little bit for you. And it was useful to me, so I'm hoping you'll be interested in too. James Galbraith is a professor of economics and social policy at University of Texas, Austin. Notably, he was in China, or worked with China, from 93 to 97 as a chief technical advisor for macroeconomic reform to the State Planning Commission of the PRC. So he knows China well, and he's co-authored a book with Jing Chen, who may be mainland Chinese, Entropy Economics, the Living Basis of Value and Production, which sounds like an ecological economics approach, which we won't get into the book because it's in the weeds, but that's the second part of the interview that Brian Edwards Tiekert did. So, no Momia Abu Jamal. I had a evergreen one handy in case something snafu'd with my the way I'm presenting material today. But it looks like we've got Breaking the Sound Barrier with Amy Goodman. I haven't been keeping up with her this week. Some of the stuff is just so grim that it's hard to believe, which leads me to the third segment, which is I do have a segment from Nora Barrows Friedman from report from Electronic Intifada. She works with Chicago resident Ali Abu Nima, who was in the news himself for being deported out of Switzerland before he could give his talk. All right, here's, again, this was version 3, according to the icon or the tag on this file from Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Website. It doesn't reflect the Supreme Court unanimity that I don't think would actually satisfy the law professor Chemerinsky that I'll be playing to later. He talks a lot about trepidation about where the extreme court will end up.
Kilmer Abrego Garcia, just one of Trump's disappeared. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. In March 2023, Donald Trump addressed CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference.
In 2016, I declared, I am your voice. Today, I add, I am your warrior. I am your justice. And for those who have been wronged and betrayed, I am your retribution.
Since taking office, Trump has kept up his promise to unleash retribution, like his promised mass deportations and his constant demonization of immigrants. Take, for example, the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, who left El Salvador at the age of 16. His mother ran a successful food business, and a local gang had extorted the family and threatened to kill him. He fled to the U.S. and settled in Maryland, working as a day laborer. In 2019, during Trump's first term as president, Abrego Garcia was arrested and accused without evidence of being an MS-13 gang member. In an immigration hearing held by Trump's own Justice Department, Abrego Garcia was cleared of gang membership and granted asylum due to the threats he faced back in El Salvador. Abrego Garcia was released with a work permit. He resumed his life in Maryland with his U.S. citizen wife and their three children. He was working as a union sheet metal apprentice when this past March 12th, he was again arrested by ICE with no warrant. He was taken to Baltimore. Then he told his wife over the phone he thought he was in Louisiana. The last time he was able to contact anyone was March 15th, when he called his wife from Texas and told her he was being sent to El Salvador's notorious terrorism confinement center, or CECOT. Kilmer Abrego Garcia hasn't been heard from since. His family is suing for his release. Judge Paula Zinnes of the Federal District Court in Maryland questioned a career DOJ immigration attorney, Erez Rivaini, about Abrego Garcia's detention in CECOT. "Why is he in CECOT, of all places?" the judge asked. "Mr. Rivaini, I don't know. That information has not been given to me," unquote. The Trump administration, after transferring Abrego Garcia to El Salvador, now says it can't return him. Quote, "Very practically, why can't the United States get Mr. Abrego Garcia back?" Judge Zinnes asked. Attorney Erez Rivaini replied, "Your Honor, I will say, for the court's awareness, that when this case landed on my desk, the first thing I did was ask my clients that very question. I've not received to date an answer that I find satisfactory," unquote. Following that candid exchange, Todd Blanche, Trump's former defense attorney, who now serves as U.S. Deputy Attorney General, suspended Rivaini from his career position as a top DOJ immigration lawyer. Judge Zinnes ordered the government to bring Abrego Garcia home, but the Trump administration claims it cannot, even though they're paying El Salvador $6 million to imprison immigrants. A federal appeals court agreed with Zinnes. The Trump administration brought the case before the U.S. Supreme Court, which promptly ordered the U.S. to facilitate Abrego Garcia's release from Salvadoran custody and grant him due process.
What was different about this case is that we brought it to their attention, we filed a lawsuit, and there was just essentially no response whatsoever.
Abrego Garcia's attorney, Simon Sandoval Moschenberg, said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
The posture of the administration has been, yeah, we made a mistake. No, we're not going to do anything whatsoever to fix it. And no court can order us to fix it. That's really what's remarkable.
There are hundreds more who've been removed to CECOT, all of them accused without evidence by Trump and his subordinates of being dangerous gang members. An estimated 90% of them have no criminal records. Most of them were rounded up and shipped to El Salvador under the authority claimed by Trump using the Alien Enemies Act of 1798, a law that has only been used a handful of times in U.S. history, most recently during World War II. International students at universities across the nation are also being targeted, having their visas revoked if suspected of engaging in Palestine solidarity protests. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said that any student that creates a ruckus while in the U.S. will have their visa revoked. So far, an estimated 300 students have been stripped of their visas. Several have been arrested.
What is Trump doing?
Constitutional law scholar and Georgetown law professor David Cole asked on Democracy Now.
He's targeting the most vulnerable. He's targeting immigrants. He's targeting dissidents. He's targeting transgender folks. He's targeting people of color. But he's also seeking to neutralize any place where there might be opposition, the checks and balances. So removing heads of agencies, removing inspectors general, targeting the press and punishing them if they disagree, targeting law firms and punishing them if they disagree, and now also targeting universities and punishing them in totally unlawful ways.
There is a force more powerful than authoritarians, the power of people organized in solidarity and resistance. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
So that was updated to reflect the unanimous decision of the Extreme Court to facilitate, doesn't enjoin, the administration. That's the first time I'd heard the concept that we're paying for the service, so we ought to be able to actually modify what's going on with some of these inmates. They all should be brought back to have individual hearings, which is the Supreme Court earlier said has to go on in the future in an earlier ruling that was also pretty lame and not going further. And there'll be more discussion of that in the piece recorded on Thursday, which doesn't reflect the case. I kind of left that main first part off. I have a programming announcement. I'll be substituting something for the Friday Forum rebroadcast. The university has not been forthcoming on how many student visas locally have been revoked, but the atmosphere has chilled speech on campus. Why isn't on campus, but technically, but the speakers were not willing to go on record, and quite understandably, the same was at the case at the very good immigration forum at the IMC on Tuesday, I believe it was this week. Quite informative, but too delicate in some of the reflections. Some of the stuff could have been heard on the air, and commend you to some of the work from Brian Doliner at his Sentences Substack. If you search for Sentences Substacks like I did, it came up. So that was called The Art of Recreating Transnational Solidarities Against Global Apartheid. I did stay on and record a speaker, Sudanese guy from Berkeley, UC Berkeley. But there were some problems in the recording there, too, so I'm not sure I'll be able to bring that segment tomorrow like I was thinking about. And Wednesday, I'll try to do something on women, life, and freedom in the Iranian gender apartheid issue that they're talking about. The last one will be a land defender, somebody who's been on Democracy Now!, Tara Hauska. I'm not sure how to say that exactly. She's the founder of the my new glasses. Ginwa Collective, G-I-N-I-W Collective. She'll be presenting this Friday as the finale of the Friday Forum series. Okay. I think I should get to the segment on tariffs, since we were just talking about that on higher ground. This again is probably quite well introduced by the speaker is, I'm working on a different system here, and it's hard for me to navigate, but I've got it now. So here's John Kenneth Galbraith. Oh, actually, I guess I may, as long as I'm stumbling around here, why don't I do an underwriting announcement?
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and by Urbana Acupuncture. Urbana Acupuncture offers safe, gentle, and effective relief for pain and stress while promoting overall health. Urbana Acupuncture, located inside Lincoln Square Mall in downtown Urbana. For more information and scheduling, please visit urbana-acu.com.
That's one of my favorites. I bought a moxibustion kit there. The generous donations have matched the $10,000 matching grant. So we raised $20,000 to help repair the WEF transmitter. A new feed line was pulled up. It wasn't a very nice day for that kind of tower work, but they did it. Business out of Chicago. WEF Tower Power 2025 fundraiser will continue. You can go to weft.org and donate. It always brings something here. Slide a check under the door. But if you want to do electronics, you could do a payroll deduction too in any time through the system that's available to state workers and U of I workers. There is static on the signal, so that was not the feed line's problem. There's something else going on. We're hoping it's in the broadcast chain and not in the transmitter, at least I am. So hopefully you're not hearing it right now. It's not as bad for talk shows, indeed. So here's Brian Edwards Tekert with James Galbraith, if I've labeled this correctly.
Economics and Social Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. His latest book, co-authored with Jing Chen, is Entropy Economics, the Living Basis of Value and Production. James Galbraith, welcome back to KPFA.
Thanks very much. It's great to be with you.
We seem to mostly talk to you during periods of great crisis and upheaval. It was almost a weekly occurrence during the sovereign debt crisis in Greece and other parts of Europe. It can't bode well that you're doing the rounds again.
Yes, well, I put these things on my syllabus, and then I tell my students that I arrange great crises so that they will correspond to the readings that I've been assigning.
I should say, because the news cycle is moving so fast, we are recording this on Thursday, April 10th, with the intention of airing it the morning of Friday, April 11th. This is the week of the trade war, the week of all the responses to Donald Trump's announcement that he is tariffing almost every country in existence and a couple without populations, and then his abrupt rollback of the lion's share of those tariffs. And I'm wondering, like, from your perch as an economic expert in the academy, what you have made of this administration and what it seems to be trying to accomplish.
Well, that is a question which might better be addressed to a psychologist than an economist. But I would say that the overarching drive behind this administration is dominance, an attempt to assert and establish a strong negotiating position and to be perceived as having a dominant negotiating position. That seems to be the overriding preoccupation. But what we are seeing is a policy which is obviously flexing back and forth with the circumstances and the response to the reaction of the markets and presumably internal pressures in the administration. So like any administration, but only more so, this one is divided between multiple tendencies and has that's been showing in the fluctuations of the policy.
Trump does seem to have a sincere preoccupation with trade deficits. The notion that if the United States is purchasing more from a country than it is selling to that country, it is somehow on the losing end of the arrangement.
That's a very peculiar view, but it is certainly one aspect of what the president has been emphasizing. Obviously, the United States has been running trade deficits consistently since the late 1960s. And I think without interruption since the early 1990s. So this is not a new problem or a new phenomenon. What we have been, the consequences of doing so are, on the one hand, a general erosion of the productive capacities in this country, and on the other, buildup of U.S. financial assets in the rest of the world. That is going to be very difficult. Anything that has built up over 30 or 40 years, rightly or wrongly, as the result of a set of policies that really go back to the Reagan administration, extremely hard to reverse, and certainly won't be reversed by a single measure like imposing tariffs, not in any short period of time and not without a huge amount of disruption.
Right. What is problematic about that arrangement? Why is it intrinsically bad to erode the productive capacities of our country while putting more financial assets into circulation around the world?
Well, it depends a bit upon what you're concerned what your principal concerns are. There are people who are important forces who, you know, think of this in terms of, let's say, national security, military power, and so forth. But I would tend to think about it in terms of the social structure of the country. And what we have developed over the last 40 years is a country which is dominated by extremely wealthy and powerful sectors, located very highly concentrated, actually, in their geographic location, the financial sector on the East Coast and the information and technology sectors on the West Coast, with a broad middle of the country that is essentially a service-oriented economy, whose living standard is supported by the value of the dollar and the availability of imports distributed through a system that has, you know, an integrated supply network that stretches from the Chinese manufacturer to through the Walmarts and Costcos and Targets that supply these goods, that deliver these goods to American consumers. And that is, that tends to undermine certain capacities in the population that you might find to be desirable, like the ability to make things, work in well-organized teams, the ability to form labor unions and other socialist organizations that are underpin a robust democracy. So you end up with a country which is much more dominated by high income, by high net worth person, by oligarchs, in effect, than was the case 50, 60, 70 years ago. That, to me, is the long-term implication of where we've been.
It's not intuitive, but one of the things you're saying is that the growth of the finance sector is kind of an inevitable outcome of these chronic trade deficits. If money goes out of the country to buy goods from abroad, it's going to come back in as investment capital.
Well, it doesn't really come back in that sense. It's held in, to a large extent, in U.S. government bonds in the accounts corresponding to government bonds at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. So it's not, and it's not necessarily playing an active role as such. But no, the point would be that when you lose the broad-based industrial operations, and you undermine the agricultural strength of the country over time as well, as a result of having a very highly valued currency, what's left is a global financial system, and of course the information technology sector. So those have been the big relative gainers, absolute gainers as well. But they concentrate wealth and power in the country in very small numbers of people and in very small parts of the geographic expanse of the country.
We've, you know, as you might imagine, and I'm sure you've engaged with, spoken to plenty of people on the left over the years who have been critical of the current trade regime, who have been concerned specifically about China entering an overproduction crisis where it's effectively dumping products onto U.S. markets and undermining labor standards here by doing so. And, you know, when we circle back to some of those people during this current round of trade wars, they say it's not bad to attack the status quo. They're just not doing it competently. I'm curious where you land on those basic questions. Is the current order worth upending?
Well, first of all, I would argue that the root of the difficulty goes back before they moved to free trade, before NAFTA, before China joined the WTO. It goes back to the late 70s and early 1980s and to the policy of breaking the unions and breaking the manufacturing sector in order to control inflation in order to restore the dollar as the basis of the world system. That was done by the Federal Reserve under Paul Volcker in the first months of the Reagan administration, and the process has unfolded from there. So I don't put the primary source of responsibility on the trading regime. Secondly, with respect to China, I think that it's a conceit on the part of many Americans to believe that China's growth and development has been the result of American policy or the defects of American policy. China is an enormous country. It has followed a policy of cycles of reform and transformation ever since since the 1940s, but especially successfully since the end of the Maoist period in the middle 1970s. And that began with agricultural reform, industrial urbanization, industrialization. Opening up was a part of that, but let's not overstate the the dependence of China on external markets. It's fundamentally a country that has been operating its own development strategy and doing so with great success.
Great success, but some setbacks recently, right? They've had a bubble and crash in their real estate sector. They certainly don't have enough domestic demand to soak up the production from their manufacturing sector.
China runs from one set of internal problems to another. The real estate problem is certainly one phase of the response to the great financial crisis. There was a lot of investment in real estate, and now they have this, it's shaking out. But as I said, these are problems which, if you view them from the standpoint of China itself, it's best to think of them as internal problems, and one which the external position of the Chinese government and the Chinese economy is important, but it's not the primary thing.
I guess the distillation of the critique would be that the Chinese government picks a sector, say solar panels, subsidizes its development to such a degree that they are produced for export incredibly cheaply, and then puts producers in other countries out of business in much the same way we might assail a Walmart for doing predatory pricing to put local businesses out of business so it can raise prices down the line. Is that a thing, and is it a thing worth worrying about?
Well, you know, I would say, put it in a different light. China's a country which whose energy supply does not is not as oriented toward oil as the U.S. is. It does not a major domestic producer of oil, so it has coal, and of course it has vast deserts and lots of sunlight. And so the movement to expand into the use of solar panels in China is a strategy which is in line with the movement toward increasing the use of electric vehicles in China, where again you're using the domestically available sources of energy. Chinese businesses operate with relatively low profit margins, and they operate with the credit support, long-term credit support from the Chinese banking system, and this gives them naturally cost advantages and scale advantages, and they're dealing with an enormous domestic market, which also gives them the corresponding advantages in the international market. We say they're dumping their products on the international market. But I think if you look at the scale of solar adoption in China, it would be clear that their primary objective is to reduce their dependence on outside energy resources, not to somehow make more money on the export market.
But by definition, if you're as big as China is, if you produce something for the domestic market, you are hitting an economy of scale that will undercoat production in most other places.
That is exactly right. And that's the same process, was observed in the United States as we were the leading producer of automobiles in the early part and middle part of the 20th century. How did we do it? By increasing scale and reducing costs and improving quality. And the Chinese are following the same model. I don't know that. I mean, I don't think it's profitable to engage in the game of saying they're somehow stealing something from us or cheating on us. They're simply a large country which has been able to pursue a development strategy which has led to very considerable gains for their account.
The Trump administration's line on its tariffs, which as we speak on Thursday, I believe are set to be 124% on goods imported from China. Its line is that in a trade war, China has more to lose than the United States because China is so reliant economically on exports to the United States. Is that how you think a tit for tat shakes out?
Perhaps the Trump administration expected the Chinese to react differently than they did to the imposition of tariffs. Many other countries apparently called up the State Department or whoever they telephoned and said, let's talk about this. And as a result, the administration paused those tariffs for 90 days, and we don't know what the final outcome would be. But the Chinese do not react that way. This is a very proud country. It is a country which has a long history of having experienced humiliation at the hands of the West. And it is simply, and has since 1949, followed a different course. It doesn't bend its knee. It doesn't tuck its forelock. So negotiations will have to proceed on the basis of equals meeting equals, or they won't proceed at all. What will happen next, it really depends upon the American side. As I said earlier, it seems that the psychology of the administration is a psychology of dominance. And if that's the case, then we may be at an impasse where neither side is going to back down. I don't think the Chinese psychology, by the way, is one of dominance. It's simply one of not being dominated. And that's incompatible with the basic approach that the Trump administration has taken to the rest of the world.
Right. I guess my question is, if we proceed forward on this present course where the U.S. imposes high tariffs on China and China responds with high tariffs on U.S. exports, as well as some controls on critical minerals that it sells to U.S. producers as inputs, who experiences the most pain?
I think the threat is to the American consumer, that you see an enormous supply chain, a very well-established, very efficient supply chain for imported goods coming from Asia, especially coming from China. And if those supplies are curtailed, and they may well be in the process of being curtailed as we speak, in the sense that shipments being canceled, then you're going to find that the pressure is going to be on the profits of the supply networks, on the Walmarts, on the Targets, on the Costcos, on the other large operations that are now very deeply embedded in the daily lives of a large part of the American population. And if their profitability is curtailed, then they end up not being able to continue to function as they have been. That will affect supplies from everywhere, including that part of their sales that come from within the United States. So you could potentially see a huge disruption to the daily life in the United States. I don't think you will see a huge disruption to daily life in China, because they're essentially, as you say, exporting a surplus to the United States in return for dollars, essentially for a dollar reserve that will pile up in the accounts of the People's Bank of China. Now, there would be some and a certain amount of reduction in the activity of certain parts of the Chinese economy that are dependent on sales of the United States. But there are large parts that aren't. There are large parts that sell internally, and there are large parts that sell to the rest of the world, not necessarily the same sectors. I noticed that the largest single export from China to the United States is actually smartphones in 2024, $64 billion. And that is spelled Apple. That's Apple. So you're looking at, in terms of the effect on the two countries, you're looking at something which could affect quite a number of workers in China. I think there are 250,000 of them at Foxconn. It will affect one of the largest and most heavily capitalized companies in the world, in the United States, even more.
To the extent that there's someone in the Trump administration who actually articulates a theory of these tariffs and why they're good, I guess that would be Peter Navarro, former academic economist, who's now back in the second Trump administration as a senior counselor for trade and manufacturing. Like, what do you understand his theory of trade wars being a good thing to be?
Excellent question, and I simply don't understand what Peter Navarro thinks this policy is going to achieve in any reasonable period. I mean, like many people, and again, to some degree, like myself, he sees the decline of the U.S. industrial position as problematic, and maybe we don't quite share the same reasoning, but I certainly share that view. I think you need to have a balanced economy and particularly over a large country like the United States, it needs to be regionally balanced in a way and sectorally balanced in a way that permits that mitigates the kinds of vast inequalities that we've seen grow up in our economy. Are we going to get there by imposing this scheme of tariffs on the rest of the world, imposing heavy tariffs on some of the poorest countries of the world who don't buy American goods because there's nothing we sell that they basically can afford, or very little? Are we going to get there by getting into a trade war with China, which has some very high cards in such a confrontation? My answer to that is no.
The thing that seems to have backed
answer to that is no, Peter Navarro. That's James Galbraith. Wikipedia has one of his influences, John Kenneth Galbraith, and I would say that's quite likely. As I mentioned earlier, in the 90s, he was technical advisor to the State Planning Commission of People's Republic, so I think he knows the ground well. Jin Cheng is his co-author, latest book, Entropy Economics, The Living Basis of Value and Production. That's what they talk about in the second part of this upfront episode, which is available as a podcast if you want to hear more of it. And I better play an underwriting announcement here and close the door, I guess.
That's James Galbraith.
Programming is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and SunPower by Legacy Solar. Based in Towanda, Illinois, a proud supporter of WEFT, SunPower by Legacy Solar provides services throughout the state of Illinois, specializing in residential and commercial solar power installations. Learn more at LegacySolarPower.com or by following their Facebook page, SunPower by Legacy Solar.
So the other thing ruining my sleep this week was all this legal whatever you call it, fracas going on with the challenge to a variety of rulings by a variety of judges. Khalil has been readied for deportation by a judge in Louisiana, where that's predictable. That's why they sent him there. But there's another case, I believe in New Jersey, that might have something to say about that. That's the person who was liaison to the administration at the Columbia pro-Palestinian demonstrations. Of course, you've heard a lot about it. To sort some of this out, again, this was recorded Thursday, as the head of the law school at UC Berkeley, Chemerinsky, here interviewed by Mitch Jezerich, former Washington, D.C. correspondent for Pacifica so many years ago.
There's also over 200 individuals who have already been taken to El Salvador prison. These are individuals who are alleged to be members of a Venezuelan gang. We know some were taken there by mistake. But I want to be clear, this is illegal under American law. There is no authority of the government to put people in prison in another country. Also, federal law is so clear that before anybody can be deported, they're entitled to due process, notice, and hearing. None was provided here.
And the Supreme Court affirmed that it was illegal to do that, didn't it, on Monday? But back to the other point, it's now without outside of the jurisdiction.
The Supreme Court's ruling on Monday was very narrow. What the Supreme Court said was that those who are in the United States pending deportation to El Salvador have to bring their habeas corpus petition in federal district court in Texas, where they're being held, not federal district court in Washington, D.C. And the court said that before they're taken out of the country, they should be given notice and a hearing. But notably, the Supreme Court didn't address the Venezuelans, and there's over 200 of them, who are already in El Salvador. And the court didn't address, what if the government violates this and takes the people to El Salvador nonetheless? Does any court have jurisdiction? That's why the brief filed by the Solicitor General on Monday is so important, because it claims once somebody is in El Salvador prison, no United States court has jurisdiction. Indeed, last Friday, the White House press secretary said, and this related to the Garcia case, well, go to the president of El Salvador and ask for release, but we believe no court has jurisdiction to order his release.
No, those are pretty shocking comments, sort of to respond to this. So once you're outside of the United States, even if it was illegal, what can you do about it? Is that the point?
That's exactly the point. I mean, in the Solicitor General's brief that I keep referring to said, no court can provide relief to people once they're taken outside the United States, which would mean that the government could take non-citizens or citizens, rightly or wrongly, dump them in an El Salvador prison, and no one would ever be able to relieve. This is a Stalin-esque gulag that they're trying to create. And again, that's why we said, if the Supreme Court were to allow this, we all should be very, very afraid.
You felt that the Supreme Court punted on some of the big issues that it was facing in this case?
Well, the court has not yet issued a ruling as to Garcia. It did issue a very narrow ruling on Monday with regard to Venezuelans who have not yet been taken to El Salvador. But the court on Monday, I'll use your word, punted on so many issues. The Trump administration claimed authority to do this under a 1798 statute, the Alien Enemy Act, that applies when there is a declared war or an imminent military invasion. It's a law that's only been used in the War of 1812, World War I, and World War II. The Supreme Court didn't address whether the government can use that power here. Second, the court didn't address, even if the statute applies, can individuals be taken and put in prison in El Salvador? No federal law authorizes that. And most important, if people are already in prison in El Salvador or taken there wrongly, can they then get judicial review? What recourse is available to them? Those are the crucial questions, and the Supreme Court didn't address any of them.
And indeed, this was recorded on Thursday. Friday, there was this unanimous ruling that Garcia should be brought back, but it said that the Trump administration should facilitate his return. It did not enjoin the Trump administration to return, to get him back. So even though they're paying $10 million for the incarceration services of the of these prisoners. Back to Chermaninsky of the law school at Berkeley.
It's one line of thought that the court was trying to avoid a potential confrontation with the Trump administration and avoid the potential of the Trump administration just ignoring the court orders, which could have a huge effect in how our system works.
This is about human beings imprisoned in a horrific maximum security prison in El Salvador. It's the role of the court to enforce the constitutional laws of the United States, especially when you're dealing with human beings and those basic form of liberty and freedom. There's going to be a confrontation with the Trump administration. The Supreme Court is going to have to declare things like this illegal or unconstitutional. If the Supreme Court doesn't, out of fear that their orders might be defied, then the Trump administration can do whatever it wants.
Do you think that's a possibility of that happening?
At this moment, I don't know where the Supreme Court is going to draw the line. I hope they'll draw the line at the Garcia case, because as you pointed out, last week, a Justice Department lawyer admitted to the court that he was taken to El Salvador by mistake. But to this point, the Supreme Court has more sided with Donald Trump than ruled against Donald Trump. There have been four Supreme Court rulings so far. Three of the four have gone against Donald, have gone in favor of Donald Trump. The fourth that went against Trump was a 5-4 on an issue that should have been unanimous against him. So I don't think at this moment we have enough information to know, will the Supreme Court actually be a check on Donald Trump?
And this really kind of gets at the heart of how our system works, is what happens if a president and administration ignores court rulings. The court doesn't have any guns, doesn't have a military force, doesn't have a police force. It sort of gets to this nature of brute power that can, I suspect, if as long as you have the military willing to go with you, for a brute power to prevail, I suppose.
I think it's important to remember that every president in history, Republican and Democrat, conservative and liberal, has always complied with court orders, even when they strongly disagree with them. Franklin Roosevelt complied with the court orders that struck down New Deal programs. Richard Nixon complied with the court order to release the Watergate tapes, even though it ended his presidency. I know many people quote Andrew Johnson saying, Chief Justice John Marshall made his ruling, let him enforce it. Andrew Jackson never actually said that. It was attributed to him 20 years after he died. Indeed, in the case involved, Worcester versus Georgia, it was not even an order directed at Andrew Jackson. It was directed at the state of Georgia. If Donald Trump chooses to defy court orders, this will be unprecedented in American history. But keep in mind the stakes here. If a president can violate the Constitution and then defy court orders, the president can do anything. That's a dictator. Then the president really could lock up you or me or anybody else in El Salvador. And even if a court issued an order to release us, he could defy it. We then would be in a form of government never seen in the United States in all of its history.
Do the courts have any recourse? And I mean, obviously the Congress can impeach. That's the one power it has over the executive branch. But can the court, does the court have any recourse to that kind of action, to ignoring an order that the executive branch ignores?
The court has the contempt power, and there's criminal contempt for violating its orders. I don't think the president can be held in criminal contempt because of a Supreme Court decision last July 1st, Trump versus the United States, that a president can't be criminally prosecuted for official acts taken in office. But those below the president could be held in criminal contempt. However, It's the United States Department of Justice that prosecutes criminal contempt, and the president can pardon for criminal contempt. There's civil contempt, which allows a person to be fined or even put in jail until they comply with the court order. And those below the president could be held in civil contempt and even jailed. But it's the United States Marshals that enforce civil contempt, and they're part of the Justice Department under Attorney General Pam Bondi and under President Donald Trump. So if ultimately a president says, I'm going to defy the court orders and do whatever I want, there's not much the courts can do about it. And then the question would be, would Congress be willing to stand up? And at this moment, of course, hard to imagine a majority of the House and 2/3 of the Senate vote impeach and remove Donald Trump.
Yeah, but maybe if it got to that point, you never know what would happen if we ever got to that point, because it does seem an extreme point to be. And it does show, I guess, this is one of those things we talk about, norms, right? The norms that the executive branch will enforce the decisions by the judicial branch.
You're exactly right. Our Constitution depends so much on the good faith of those who govern us, and that they will follow the norms of the office. One of those norms is that presidents, like everyone else in society, complies with court orders. And I want to be clear, this is nonpartisan. The idea of the rule of law applies equally to Republicans and Democrats. And the rule of law is that no one, not even a president, is above the law.
We've also had the detention and really the abduction on the street of students who were involved in pro-Palestinian protests last year. Mahmoud Khalili from Colombia, several others now. Do those fall in sort of, how different are those cases from these previous ones that we're talking about where people are being jailed in El Salvador?
Well, of course, at this point, what we're seeing is that their visas are being revoked and they're going to be deported. There isn't an indication that this group of people is being put in El Salvador, but what's being done to them is nonetheless unconstitutional. The United States Supreme Court has been clear that all who are in the United States have freedom of speech under the First Amendment. In 1945, in a case involving labor leader Harry Bridges, a case called Bridges versus Wixon, the Supreme Court was clear that non-citizens in the United States have free speech. So to revoke somebody's visa because the government doesn't like the views of that person violates the Constitution.
Yeah, and Harry Bridges right here in San Francisco with the dock workers and the general strike
exactly.
That happened in the
30s. The Longshoremen Union.
Yeah.
And the government tried very hard to deport him for his advocacy. Took years, but ultimately he prevailed. But the 1945 case, Bridges versus Wixon, remains so important in saying that non-citizens have free speech rights too.
Do these cases now with these students present an opportunity of changing that precedent from the Bridges case?
Of course, but I hope not. I hope that the Supreme Court will continue to say that all in the United States are entitled to free speech and that the government can't punish people, including revoking visas and deporting them, just because the government dislikes the views that they're expressing. The First Amendment, if you look at the language, doesn't say anything about citizen or non-citizen. And in fact, if you look at the Due Process Clause, it says no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. It doesn't say no citizen.
It just seems we're at this moment in time right now, this turning point in history. We already talked about one potential extreme. That would be the president just absolutely ignoring what the courts say. But there's other possibilities, including one, the court stopping many of the president's initiatives, or conversely to that, the court kind of redefining what our legal expectations have been over, I guess, since what, the Warren Court or so.
Well, when it comes to the free speech of everyone in the country, that long precedes the Warren Court. I mean, the case that I mentioned was from 1945 and the Warren Court began in 1953. But I think something even more fundamental is at stake. As we've been talking about, this is about whether the president will comply with the Constitution, whether the president will comply with the rule of law. One thing that's striking so far is that the federal district courts on so many issues have ruled against President Trump and issued temporary restraining orders and preliminary injunctions. So far, in all of these cases, when they've gone to the Federal Court of Appeals, the district court orders against the Trump administration are upheld. Four matters have gone to the Supreme Court. 3 out of 4, the Supreme Court has reversed the lower courts. But the rulings have been narrow, and the Supreme Court hasn't yet dealt with the hard issues.
Yeah. Hard to follow. That's Ed Chermaninsky. I'm not saying it right. Been talking WEF stuff here in the meantime. He is dean of the law school at UCal Berkeley, and he's not terribly a fan of the Constitution, but he does want it to be enforced till we do something better. No democracy lasts forever. How the Constitution threatens the United States is his latest book. His opinion piece in the New York Times that might have elicited this interview, which you can find at Letters in Politics. It's a freestanding podcast if you want to hear the rest of it. The opinion piece was, "We should all be very, very afraid." And now, controversially, I'm going to play what I can of the Electronic Intifada Weekly Roundup. Incredibly grim stuff, but I feel obliged to hear this since we're not hearing things. A lot of things are not being relayed. I've been particularly annoyed with NPR in that BBC reports that Katz, the defense minister, says, "We are implementing the transfer agreement as per Trump's outline." And that I have not heard on any media in the U.S. If you've heard it, searching for it doesn't get you much either. And I mentioned that I was operating under a new... Here we go. We'll hear what we can of Nora Barris Friedman's report. I'll be having to edit this. This is also from a KPFA product called Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, though they're presenting Nora Barris Friedman, which is a freestanding podcast to Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 552 of the genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has committed massacres across all areas of the Gaza Strip, while for 6 weeks now it has closed all the crossings for food, fuel, medicines, construction vehicles, and every other essential supply, plunging Gaza into another deep starvation and health crisis. More than 390,000 people are estimated to have been displaced again, according to the United Nations, with no safe place to go. Every day, dozens are killed in Israeli attacks. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said that in the last 3 weeks since Israel broke the ceasefire on March 18th, Israel has killed nearly 1,500 Palestinians. Al Jazeera reporter Anas Al-Sharif shared this video of Israeli firebelt strikes hitting Gaza City on April 3rd. Our contributor Abu Bakr Abed has been reporting on the attacks over the last week on Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, where his cousin and his cousin's child were killed at the gates of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital on Saturday. The Israeli army has issued forced expulsion orders to residents of Deir al-Balah in the past few days, threatening residents with attacks if they do not leave. The Israeli military said that it carried out 45 separate attacks across Gaza between Tuesday and Wednesday alone. On Wednesday, April 9th, Israel attacked the Shejaiya neighborhood of Gaza City, destroying dozens of residential buildings and killing dozens of Palestinians. An eyewitness told the Al Jazeera network that, quote, "We were talking in the street and suddenly we were shocked to see these buildings' bricks flying apart, in addition to flying hands and feet." Another survivor added, quote, "It is a massacre with the full meaning of the word. I haven't seen or heard about a massacre like this since the start of the war. Most of the martyrs are children and defenseless civilians." Mahmoud Bassal, the spokesperson for Gaza's Civil Defense Corps, said that there were dozens of people missing and stuck underneath the rubble. Al Jazeera's reporter Hani Mahmoud said on Wednesday that, quote, "The army not only dropped multiple bombs, but these were also earthquake bombs that shook the very foundations of nearby buildings, destroying the majority of them. Entire residential buildings have been turned into ruins. A large number of casualties arrived at Al-Ahli Arab Hospital in Gaza City, but they are struggling because there is not sufficient medical care available due to shortages of supplies and doctors. Mahmoud said that civil defense crews needed to stop their rescue operations because armed Israeli quadcopter drones hovered above them. Also on Wednesday, Israeli airstrikes bombed the tents of displaced families in the so-called safe zone of Al-Mawasi, killing three Palestinians, including a child. The day before, on April 8th, Israel bombed Al-Mawasi. Doctors Without Borders said that its teams in the nearby clinic received nine victims after a strike hit 300 meters away from the facility. Two were dead on arrival, including a two-year-old boy, and the seven others were wounded. Dr. Mohammed Shath, an emergency room doctor working at the clinic, said, quote, "Honestly, I can't describe the scene and the injuries in the stomach, head, and chest. Absolute horror." On April 7th, Israel bombed a community kitchen, also in Al-Mawasi, that was distributing meals to displaced families. Four children were killed in the airstrike. This video by journalist Samer Abu Samra shows a man carrying the body of a small girl who is wearing a traditional Palestinian thobe. He says, quote, "Look, they're all children, all of them." Another man says that the kitchen workers were distributing rice and lentils to children and Israel bombed them. And another witness says that the girl is five and the oldest of the children who were killed was six. "This is so wrong," he says. "Nothing in the world justifies the killing of children."
شو كان بيعمل
والله كان بوضع رز قاعدين رز والله رز كان بوضع عدس والله رز وعدس بوضع على الفار ضربوهم اخوي راح انا خمس سنين ست سنين اكبر بنت فيها حرام والله والله ما بقول يا زلمه بناتي يموت ايش يعني راح يجيبوا اكل ياكل كيف انا يا عمي خلصونا شو هذا ايش واكل اجيب الباكل مطروح عندك اياه.
In the south, the Gaza government media office said on April 7th that Rafah is, quote, "the city that the Israeli occupation wiped off the map and turned into a complete humanitarian disaster." The media office stated that Israel has transformed the entire Rafah governorate, quote, "into a closed military operations zone, completely isolating it from the rest of the Gaza Strip and considering it a complete red zone. It continues to commit horrific massacres against defenseless civilians, causing the systematic and comprehensive destruction of infrastructure, vital facilities, and residential homes, rendering the city uninhabitable. The occupation army, the media office added, quote, "has completely destroyed more than 90% of the homes in Rafah Governorate, representing more than 20,000 buildings containing more than 50,000 housing units. In addition, 22 of the 24 water wells were destroyed, including the main Canada well, and the distribution pumps, depriving tens of thousands of families of safe drinking water." The isolated Rafah governorate was not only bombed, but was systematically destroyed and obliterated in a scene that reflects the occupation's premeditated intent to empty the land of its people and alter its geographic and demographic features, the office stated. Quote, "We affirm that these crimes will not pass without accountability and that the steadfastness of the people of Rafah governorate and the rest of our people will remain a living witness that the will to live is stronger than the machine of death." The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza reported this week that while medical teams and ambulance crews continue to operate under life-threatening conditions to save lives, 37% of medications and 59% of all medical supplies are at zero stock. This includes medications for operating rooms, intensive care units, and emergency departments that have been depleted to unprecedented levels, with higher percentages of critical medications being at zero stock, such as 54% of medications for cancer treatment, 40% of those for primary care, and 51% of medicines for maternal and child health. Furthermore, the destruction of diagnostic imaging equipment has severely restricted patients' access to these vital services, while fuel shortages threaten to shut down hospitals' essential departments that rely on generators, the health ministry added. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, warned this week that Israel's ongoing blockade of humanitarian aid is having terrible consequences for 1 million children in the Gaza Strip. And without essential food, medicine, shelter, and safe water, malnutrition, diseases, and other preventable conditions will likely surge, leading to an increase in preventable child deaths.
I said it would be grim, and it was. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. That's a regular feature of the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barris Friedman, an update on news of the week. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting. Remember, still some work to be done, still some money to be raised for cleaning up WEF signal now. The power is here. Now we just have to clean it up.